Welcome to Who Are You, a CSI podcast. I'm Raven, and I've seen CSI through and through around 3 to 4 times.
And I'm Nick, and these are my first time experiencing these episodes.
And today we are reviewing Season 4, Episode 13, Suckers. Original air date, February 5th, 2004. Director Danny Cannon, writers Anthony E. Zeiker, Danny Cannon, and Josh Berman. And we begin today's episode, how we begin many an episode, with shots of the Vegas Strip. So, Nick, what is our Vegas score?
Quite a few.
For today's episode? I was going to say, it felt like a very heavy Vegas.
Yeah, so we have a bunch, basically shots throughout the entire episode.
Yeah.
And I think, well, the official Vegas score is 55, max LV score. Yes.
Max LV.
But nice, like nice. Numerically, we were into the 70s.
Oh, wow.
I'm not even sure I was keeping track at the very end.
Yeah, you were like, all right, this is a very.
I did like a subtotal at one point.
Yeah, this is a very plus, Vegas heavy episode. And like,
that was before too. Any bonus points for being in a casino or walking through a casino floor.
A heist.
I was like, I don't need it. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Thematically, a heist.
Yeah.
This is probably the most, it's definitely one of the most Vegas episodes, but it's arguably as Vegas as it comes.
Yeah. So. We have the shots of the Vegas Strip. We hear a man speaking.
People say that Las Vegas has no culture, no history, that we emulate, not create. They forget that this was once a desert from which this city was created.
Well, first, while we're still looking at shots of the Vegas Strip, but then we go to a man at a like podium speaking to a crowd by a pool, and this is my first spot. So this is Danny Huston? Houston? Huston?
Sure. Right,
I'm gonna say Huston. Houston.
Yeah. Spelled like Houston without an O.
Yeah, that's what I'm like, I'm not quite sure. He plays Mr. Caulfield, I think. Caulfield.
Not quote unquote casino guy, as it says in my notes.
Yeah, Caulfield, that's what it is. Casino manager. And I know him as the Axeman from American Horror Story.
Oh, okay. Is that a later American Horror Story?
Season 3 or 4, maybe?
Okay. I have him down in my notes for he's the bad guy in the Wonder Woman movie with Gal Gadot, the newer one. I thought his character was Ares, but then I went and looked it up, and apparently he's not supposed to be Ares, but she spends the movie thinking he is, and okay. So that's fine. Okay. I was misremembering, but he's a bad guy. But he also plays like a basically in that movie, like a Nazi general or something.
Oh, I did. Okay, I was like, did I see that movie? And then I was like, I'm pretty sure I saw that movie. And now I'm like, I definitely saw that movie. Don't remember him from that for whatever reason. I remember him from from American Horror Story.
In like the Wolverine movies, he plays like, he's in like some of those X-Men Wolverine movies. He plays like a military guy in that too, which I was like, I don't know if I actually remember that, but I saw that on his IMDb page. And I went, yeah, I definitely know this guy from, he's been in these roles a lot. This role is a little bit different, you know, in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
So, but I couldn't put my finger on it for most of the episode, and then at the very end, he was going on a monologue. It's just a bad guy, evil villain monologues, you know.
Yeah. And you're like, wait a second, this is
just a couple extra girls on fired. And yeah, I thought I was gonna know. I thought there was something else. I kept like re-scrolling through his IMDb, being like, but like, was there anything else? And I was like, nope.
He's in the coven. Which New Orleans season of American Horror Story, which I have not seen all of the seasons of American Horror Story, but of the ones that I watched was by far my favorite season of American Horror Story.
I will call out for the audience, he's in two very popular shows, neither of which I've watched.
He's in Yellowstone.
More recent shows. He's in Yellowstone, he's in Succession.
Oh, he's in Succession, okay.
And so I'm almost wondering if I've seen ads for Succession.
Yeah, and he's been in
a lot of ads for that.
That could be in relation to that.
Yeah. And that's why I feel like I have this more recent memory of who he is. And I had a moment where I was like, is he a White Lotus? The character in this episode feels like it could be a character in White Lotus. And so, yeah, that was kind of a funny ride for me in this episode. I was like, what do I do with this guy?
Yeah, Nick was spending. I knew that I knew him, like, very first scene, which is why I'm calling the spot the guest star out here. It took Nick until, like, the end of the episode.
I basically had to figure out the last scene.
Yeah.
And I have a misspot the guest star. So I may, my brain may just not have been working right this week.
It's fine. You've had a lot going on this week. So it's understandable. So we see this man speaking to this crowd, and he's talking about an exhibition at the casino of Japanese antiquities. And as he's talking, a woman screams, and we find out quickly why. It's because there is a man facing face down in a pool. There's a live wire. So Sarah and Grissom are on scene. And
I will say, yes, as good of a time as any, during the scene, there's a security guard who's like, step back.
Yes.
Step back.
Yep.
And this is that missed spot, the guest star.
Yep.
The actor's name is Sherman Augustus, but I really only know him for one thing, which is a sci-fi TV show called Into the Badlands, which I mentioned this before we started recording, and Raven rightfully pointed out, it's basically samurai Western. So this episode deals with a lot of Japanese art artifacts. So it's a good little callback. Although I say samurai Western, that's for some reason how I view it. I really have no idea, you know, which Eastern or really probably multiple Eastern cultures that show is likely,
yeah,
you know, kid bashing into this fantasy world. But yeah, I remember liking that show a lot. And I don't know if I watched every episode, but I watched at least like two or three seasons of it. So yeah, it was a good show.
So this is not, I have a later spot to guest star. This is not them. So we'll get there in a little bit. So we have Sarah and Grissom on scene, and I have to wonder, is it very purposeful that after the last episode, the first two people from the core CSI team that we see together are Sarah and Grissom?
I think it's intentional I was trying to do the math. I'm thinking 12 episodes in, this might be like a sweeps week or a Christmas break thing or something that they've left people hanging. And they want to know, it's less about a nod to the situation. It's more about letting the audience know right out of the gate that we're just going on with our lives right now.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
and, and so like we can be around each other. It's not awkward. It's not weird or something like that. But I felt it. I was like, after watching last week's episode, seeing this side by side, I had a moment of like, oh, are they going to talk about it?
And so, spoiler alert, they don't.
No.
Doesn't happen.
Probably because they tend to write these episodes sort of like the main storyline tends to be every few weeks so that they don't have to worry about continuity.
Yeah, every single episode. We learn pretty fast that Jim Brass is already on scene. Grissom points out that there's just something odd about this. The body should have sunk. It should be sitting.
Yes.
At the bottom of the pool, and how the arms and legs are floating is like just not quite right. And Sarah goes to find the source of like the live wire, which is like a car battery, which again is also like, what? Like, why is there a car battery randomly like wired up to the pool?
I really think they had a faux pas here where Brass needed to be like, the fire department's still trying to figure out, like they're throwing all these breakers and they can't figure it out.
Yeah.
Because like the fact that there's no one else here trying to secure this live wire.
Yeah, it's Sarah's job.
It's like this. You just like when she was yelled at for not having the scene secure. It's not her job to secure the scene, right?
Yeah,
they bring them in once it's secure.
Yeah,
I mean it's all for show, right? Because it's part of the hoax in the show or whatever. But they could have just had an easy line to be like. Be like, oh yeah, we're still trying to figure out. No, we haven't been able to figure out where the like none of the circuit breakers or something or where the wire's coming from. And Christmas just like, Sarah, go check out behind that bush, you know.
Lo and behold, oh, yeah, there's a car battery there.
Yeah, I will say, as a watcher of this episode, I was like, this is ridiculous. There is no way a wire of voltage, like, that was like kill a person could still be sparking without tripping a fuse or a circuit breaker.
Causing some.
Cause it wasn't. And that is absolutely true. And it makes and I was like, oh, okay, well done. Because it was actually,
you're like, that actually does
actually not hooked up to the electrical grid.
Yeah.
So the car battery said, oh, good on you guys.
So then after they disarm the wires, so Grissom pulls the quote unquote victim out of the pool. Turns out to be a dummy. But as Grissom is saying, hey, this is like, we don't actually have a crime here. an alarm sounds, which brings the group into where the exhibition is, and there is a guard there, like, taped up with tape, and one of the glass cases is broken. So, like, it looks like at this point, at least, like, one piece from the collection has been stolen.
Smash and grabbed. I totally predicted this line where he's like, this is the crime scene.
Yeah, he's like, and this is the crime. So that brings us to credits, our nice little quip to credits. We return to Grissom pulling off the tape from the guard. Sarah realizes that the sword is the only thing that has been taken from the collection. Jim Brass walks over, talks to the guard that was taped up to get their information. Sarah finds liquid in front of a suit of armor, and it smells sweet, she notes. And then Grissom notices, like, there's, like, an empty tape roll.
Yeah, like the cardboard.
The cardboard, mirror. like when you're finished with a roll of tape, like, what is left at the end is just, like, sitting on top of, like, one of those, I don't know what you call them, that you, like,
stanchions, I think is what they're called.
Maybe, yeah.
They're the posts that the velvet ropes
yes.
go back and forth yeah. on. Or, yeah. or, you know, anytime when they're, like, a line at an amusement park or something. Like, right. the posts or a movie theater, like, the posts that the lines or the ribbons are attached to. Yeah. It's one of those. So it's perched on the top of one of those, right above where you do the little clippy rope part.
Yeah. So we...
I should say it's because it's important later. It's not perched on top. It's sitting such that the post is through the hole.
Yes. We then pop over to storyline B. We have Catherine and Warwick. They're entering an abandoned house. They're there with an officer. As they're walking through this, like, spooky, dark house, they come upon David, who is with the victim. And this victim has potential bite marks from fangs, maybe?
Yes.
On their jugular?
David's, like, really freaked out by this.
David is very freaked out by this. And it appears that this victim bled out. But where is the blood? This is weird. Because normally when we... I will say, this is, like, another, I think, decent catch of this episode. Is, generally speaking, I think every episode to date where someone has bled out, there's, like, a big pool of blood around them.
Yes.
And so, so for, like, this victim to be lying there with, like, no blood and no signs of being moved post-mortem is a good catch.
There's one, like, this is, like, one of the little things on the rewatch that I was like, wait a minute. We later find out that, like, there's a scene where blood is, like, splurting out of her neck at the very end. And it's not, like, all caught up into, like, a container. And so they'd ever do a thing with, like, was there blood? They didn't do luminol on the floor. They didn't go through any of those steps.
Yeah.
So, like, we don't really know as an audience, like, what the situation was. It's just, and that's on purpose. Like, you know, it's all about, you know, you're supposed to have this vampire idea, right? She has these two fangs, holes, and the blood is just gone, right? It's like the mystery. Yeah. But I think maybe the faux pas was in the reenactment scene later on.
Yeah.
Where it just wasn't clean.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But that was, like, it was kind of funny because I was like, first time through, I didn't catch that. And the second time through, I was like, too bad.
Yeah. But they also realized when they're on the scene that they might be able to get DNA from this victim, because if in fact someone bit them and that is what caused these puncture marks, then there should be spit. Therefore, there should be DNA. War continues through the house and he finds a symbol on the ground, which we learn soon after, not done in blood. It is done most likely in house paint. And then there's also, like, candles for, like, a ritual, you know, some sort of cult, dark arts.
Yeah.
Sort of fun times.
Like, you know, just goth kid fun.
We then return to Jim Brass with the Miss Spot the Guest Star. He's very upset, Jim Brass is, because the guest who screamed and alerted them to the person in the pool was allowed to leave. So now they're like, where is this woman?
Oh, was it that specific guest? I remember him complaining about the guest leaving, but I don't remember. I didn't realize it was for that specific person. Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
And I kind of had this idea in my head where I was like, they didn't do, like, a very thorough job of trying. Like, they do try to track this person down throughout the episode.
Yeah.
But they it's really like a secondary effort.
Yeah. And this is where we also learn that Nick is on this case. Nick is back from his conference. He's on this case. He gives Jim Brass the rundown on dummies.
I like to think that he spent his entire conference on computer-aided reconstruction.
I would hope so.
Which will come up later in the episode.
It will definitely come up later.
It did also make me think that, like, that's the kind of skill that, like, when Grissom was learning to be a CSI, didn't exist.
Did not exist. No, for right? sure.
But now it's, like, totally exists in crime labs around the country. And, like, at some point, people, you know, you had to teach an old dog a new trick, you know?
Yeah.
So maybe those conferences are important that they keep disappearing.
Maybe, yeah. I mean, it makes sense. You gotta learn new skills and new technology as they arise. We're back with Catherine and Work. They walk into the morgue where Doc Robbins is. This is where we learn that their victim is Angela Somerville, 20 years old. But later on, we'll find out it's actually 18.
Oh, is there?
Yep.
I didn't catch that. Yep. Inconsistency.
Which?
Oh, from her parents.
Yes.
Okay.
Doc Robbins finds her license. That's how he identifies her. So he's like, Angela Somerville, 20. Which, if she was using a fake ID,
would have been
I
21.
Could understand, but would have been 21.
Yeah,
there's that's no just, point in using a fake ID to say that you're 20 years old.
Yeah, that's just a mess up. Unless you're long gaming the fake ID for next year.
Yeah, I don't know.
Only care about smoking cigarettes.
Yeah, I'm not. Well, no, you only have to be 18 to buy cigarettes, right?
Yeah. I guess, well, maybe last year she needed it. I don't know. I'm just kidding. I was just trying to figure out why you would ever need an ID that was not 21.
Yeah. So, yeah, he says that she's 20. Later on when we're talking to her parents, they'll say she's 18. Multiple times they'll reference the fact that she's 18, too. But her fangs, we learn, are made of acrylic. They're clip-on fangs. And she, on her ankle, has a tattoo. It is the Ankh. It is the same symbol that they found painted on the floor in the house. And she also has incisions on her shoulder. And so there's a conversation about how, yeah, like healed up cuts.
Yeah. I feel like most people, but a lot of people, whether it's somebody they know who was cutting or something, like, I don't know, maybe it has more to do with the people that I hung out with growing up. But yeah, it was they were a little big, but they're basically what you would expect from some kind of like purposeful cutting.
Yeah.
People. I also want to say that you probably already know this, but our audience doesn't, is that as I used to go to like goth industrial nights in my 20s, there were regularly a guy there who would fit people for vampire fangs.
Oh, yeah.
And it would take like an hour. We would almost do like 5 people a night.
Yeah, I mean,
because it takes a long time. But yeah, it would like mold her teeth.
I had custom werewolf teeth made for a character at the haunted house I worked at.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I was like, for a costume, basically.
Yeah,
right?
For costume purposes, yeah.
Yeah. But not that. This is even more hardcore. She had like her enamel.
Yeah, like filed down.
Shaved down.
Yeah. I just have natural ones.
Oh, yeah, they'll look naturally.
Yeah, I just have natural.
Spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert.
People can have naturally fanged teeth.
Weird. So weird, but it's true. So we're back with Grissom and Sarah. They're still in the exhibition hall. Grissom is processing the tape, and they're talking about the tape, we realize that it was cut at both ends. So they were like, wow. At this time, they're like, wow, these people were really pre-prepared. They pre-cut the tape that they were going to use to like tie this victim.
Yeah. I'll be honest. That probably should have been a hint to me as a viewer, because my first thought was like, you can cut tape in real time. Yep. You know what I mean?
True
like,
story.
Like you can't, you don't have to only cut the tape. The guy said he was unconscious. Like
right.
You can take your time and just cut the tape with a pair of scissors. Maybe you don't want to leave fingerprints on it, so you're not using like ripping it really hard.
Yeah.
And so you just brought a knife or a pair of scissors. I was like, why are they making a big deal out of this? Yeah. And I was like, oh, it comes up later.
It does come up later. We also learn in the scene that the liquid found in front of the suit of armor is sugar water. And they're also having a conversation where Grissom is pondering, okay, if they're going to steal something, they're in a casino. Why would you steal an antique? Like, of all the things,
I mean,
to steal from a casino.
That's in many ways antique? A bad. Like, in many ways, that's it's almost a bad line It's so weird that I'm giving this episode a hard time. As you will find out later. I quite like this episode. It's just that we're being... maybe this is actually one of the reasons why the episode's so good is that in the moment, none of these things jump out so strongly. Yeah, right? Yeah. But the episode is quite entertaining. I would think that the casino is really good at protecting its money and not its conference rooms.
Yes,
and if something in a conference room happened to be worth about as much as the vault that you were going to rob, which you know, priceless pieces of art could be.
Yes, for sure.
And that it would make a lot of sense to steal that from a casino.
Right.
You know, I was like, I feel like every heist movie you've ever seen, it's like for one night the giant diamond is going to be at this location. It's like, and they'd be like, oh, their weakness, they're so used to protecting things that are behind a vault, this is a glass case, they don't know what they're doing, we, you know, and they exploit that weakness, you know,
yeah,
as part of the plot. So I was like actually that's but they're saying it because they're foreshadowing, and it's good foreshadowing. It's just
good foreshadowing.
When you've watched the episode twice in a row, it just you start to critique it a little bit more.
It's fair.
But first time through, I was none the wiser.
We are back with Catherine and Warwick. They're entering a bedroom, Angela's bedroom. The parents are there. And we learn that when she turned 18, which is now, or like recently, she entered, she went goth. She had a few other phases.
Yeah, I mean, that could have been 2 years ago.
No, they literally said she...
Oh, they say just now. Yeah, okay.
Recently. They say she's 18, like multiple times in this.
Oh, season. Okay. Yeah.
And we pick up quite a few things, actually, that happen in the scene. One is that one of the only things that her parents essentially mandated was that she get an HIV test. So if there's going to be exchanging of blood, then we need to make sure that, you know, you get an HIV test, which, hey, safety first. If you're exchanging fluids in any sort of way, listeners, get regularly tested.
Nowadays, I would hope parents are maybe a little more educated, ask for more than just an HIV test.
Agreed, because there's more than just HIV to worry about.
And maybe, like, ask their partners. Like, you don't want to find out by getting it. So maybe the people you're engaging in risky behaviors with, you get tested before you engage in the risky behaviors.
Yeah, I just had my yearly physical after not having a yearly physical for, like, 3 years. But I got it. I finally went back. And I have a new primary care doctor because I'm in a new state and all that good stuff, so we go blah blah, and I got like the standard blood work already done, everything's great.
Yeah,
but my doctor was like, oh, did we test you for hepatitis C? And I was like, I don't think so. And she's like, you have a lot of tattoos, we really should test you for hepatitis C. And I was like, all right. I was like, if you want to, I don't
really. I mean, I thought it was going to be because hepatitis C, I think it's on the rise. Like,
oh, is it? Yeah, yeah. I guess.
Maybe that's why. I think, is Rhode Island probably less stringent than Mass? I know that you happen to get your tattoos largely through a single tattooer who
is in Massachusetts.
Very good and therefore probably very professional and clean.
He is very professional.
Yeah, so like you don't necessarily have that risk. But
no, I'm not worried about it.
If, you know, why not? There's not a lot of harm, and
that's what I was like. Sure, I was like, you want to test me for Hep C? You can test me for Hep C.
They have a drug for that now, so
this is true. And as they continue through this room, they find an altar essentially in her closet, and at the center of this altar is a picture of a man, and this is my second spot.
Oh, really? Okay.
Star.
I thought this was somebody it's not when I first saw them.
This is going to be a weird... I was hoping we would both have this so I don't feel as like weird and uncomfortable about how I know this person. So this is James Haven. He plays Lazarus Kane. I was going to say King and I was like, that's not right. He plays Lazarus Kane in this episode. I know him because he is Angelina Jolie's brother. And there's all these tabloid pictures of them like, basically making out. And it's like burned into my brain.
Is that why I thought he was so... Because he doesn't look anything like... There's like a very famous red carpet event where they went together and had vials of each other's blood, which is like very topical.
Yes, it is.
In this episode.
Yes, it is.
Oh my Lord. Wow.
So I've never actually seen him act in anything else. But I can't not know him from the cringy pictures with Angelina Jolie. Yeah.
So he looked very familiar. And you know who is it? It's Nicholas Hoof. Do you know what I'm talking about?
No, not offhand.
I think he's Holt, Nicholas Holt, if you look him up. He looks a little like him, but I was like, wait, this is like 20 years ago. Nicholas Holt would have been...
Yeah, you were like, this is not right.
Would have been like a teenager. And I was like, I don't think that's him. Nicholas Holt, ironically, is in the newest Nosferatu movie, which would also be quite the tie back. But so then I went to this person's IMDb, and he's in like a ton of movie in seemingly small bit parts. So
all movies that have Angelina Jolie in
them. Almost all movies have Angelina Jolie. She's not in Monsters Ball, which is a big movie, but then like kind of like falls off the face of the planet.
Yeah.
Right. And so I was like, oh, this person isn't a famous person. I don't know them from anywhere where, but yeah, looked very familiar. And even looking at, I'm on IMDb. There's just a lot of pictures of, like from like the like outside of acting, and I was like maybe, but I think I also mostly just think he looks like somebody else.
Yeah.
But that is hilarious. I'm glad. It makes me really happy that you saw that and got that, because even though I don't make the connection, I know who that is, and it makes this episode so much more hilarious.
Yeah. So that's my second and final spot, the guest star. We also learned the scene that she had a court. So she was not a lone vampire on her own. She had a court. So we'll come back to this court in a wee bit. But before we do, we're with Sarah and Grissom. They're back at the exhibit, and they learn that everything was moved to Mr. Caulfield's vault. So
yes, importantly, at the request of Mr. Yakimoto.
Yes. And this is one of the instances they talk about trying to track down Miss Green, the one who would have like inventoried these items as they were coming in for the exhibit, but she's on vacation. So like they'll try to reach out to her, but you know, she's like taking her time. And we also learn in the scene that Mr. Yamamoto, it was his insurance on the items, that the casino was not going to incur the risk and incur the insurance to cover this exhibit, that it was Mr. Yamamoto's own insurance, supposedly, that is covering these items.
Ironically, I recall that, and I think the importance of that was lost in me until you just said it right now.
I just said it right now.
Yeah. Because then the insurance, there will be no insurance investigator
right
on those items.
Yeah. We then have... Actually, we're right back with the court. Now we're with Warwick and Catherine. They're with the quote-unquote court. And Catherine has zero patience for this court. They don't want to answer to their given names. They don't want to refer. They won't like acknowledge who Angela is because they know her as Degana. And after some mild threatening, they fall in line. And we learn from them that none of them know. I mean, we don't even know his name is Lazarus at this point. But they show him the picture from the altar of the man. And they're like, no, none of us know who he is. But we learn that Angela was into drinking blood. None of them were. They were like,
yeah, no. She was trying to go hardcore.
Yeah. So she freaked out on them. They kicked her out of the court. They told her to leave. She refused to leave. So they left the house. And that's the last time they saw her. And we return to the exhibits and with Sarah and Grissom. And Sarah is going over the list of items, you know, that were there for the exhibit. Grissom asks about the armor. And Sarah magically has a book on the subject. Because this is before you could just pull up your phone and be like, hey, Google, tell me about armor from the 15th century.
You could Google things, but not on your phone.
Yes, Google was a thing, but you couldn't go on your phone and do it.
Yeah.
And
not everybody was Googling at that time.
This is true. Grissom gets a call from Nick. We learn that the print that was pulled off of the tape was the guard's print. So the guard that was taped up, it was his print on the tape. And Grissom demonstrates how this is done by spinning around in the chair and taping himself up. And so we learn how the self-taping happens.
Yeah, so like the idea is like the little cardboard inside of the tape was left over after he taped himself up. He couldn't throw it away. right? Yeah. And he probably pre-taped his mouth, which is why he had to cut it. He could have ripped it, but I think he was trying not to leave a fingerprint.
Yeah.
And then they never explains how he gets a big gash in his head, because he has to be taped. So presumably he would have had to do that first.
He would have taped himself up first and then.
Well, no, because he was taped to the chair. He wouldn't have been able to smash his head. True. So he would have smashed his head first.
Yeah, would have smashed his head first.
Not enough to knock himself out, but.
Yeah.
Or I guess he could have had it accomplished.
This is true.
Like, somebody could have done it, but yeah.
And as they're still in this room, they hear a rattling from the ceiling, which leads them to find the sword up there.
In the air conditioning duct.
Yeah, in the air conditioning
duct. Very Mission Impossible.
Very much so. So Grissom, Sarah, and the security / Miss Spot the Guest Star are Grissom is holding the sword as they're all walking through the casino. And they walk into this Mr. Yamamoto's suite, where Mr. Caulfield also is. And Mr. Yamamoto obviously wants his sword back. Grissom's like, no, I need to take it back to the lab. And they're asking about the suit of armor, because they're like, that's not in like the same century as like all the other pieces. And Mr. Yamamoto is like, I don't have a suit of armor. That's not a part of my exhibit. So they go to the vault, which is all asunder. And all this cash was taken, because there's all these bands.
Yeah, the
cash bands.
Money bands.
The money bands, all about. And Grissom points out that the con goes on.
Yeah.
And there's also disheveled armor. There's armor just in
pieces. The suit of armor is like that they've been talking about is like melted on the floor.
Yes. Yes.
I also say, I can't tell how intentional this is, or if this is just bad acting or some kind of personal bias. But I really didn't think Mr. Yakamoto sounded anything but American half the time, which could be a clue, which could be an intentional clue for the audience, or could just be they cast an American actor and didn't have much of an accent, or I don't know.
Yeah. So we are then with Grissom and Sarah. They're in the vault processing evidence. We learn that the glucose, the sugar water that was identified earlier on, was the food source for the person who was in the armor. And also they find a bag of urine, because they were in the armor for a long period of time.
I thought they were going to tell us this person was diabetic.
Because
you could easily be in a suit of armor without eating for a couple of days if you had to.
What you needed
was water.
Yes.
Because you will get dehydrated, and that will make you really not have a good time long before the lack of sugar will get to you.
Yeah.
And there's not enough water in the glucose to replace the water that you need. And so like I was like, but it's not, if you just found some water on the floor, it wouldn't be cool. So
they had to add a little something to it. Grissom also finds a recorder which recorded the code to the vault, which is a bit of a musical number.
This is probably my favorite piece of evidence in the whole episode.
Oh really?
I want to just put a pin in that and let's talk about it.
Okay. We'll talk about
at
it
the
later.
End once the. Okay. Or maybe once the ruse of the episode is sort of exposed, because there's like too many layers. I just have to talk about the rest of the episode to talk about why it's such a cool piece of evidence.
All right. Sounds good. We're back with Warwick and Catherine. They walk into the room where Greg Sanders is. He gives them weapons in their fight against the vampires. He hands them like a stake and a cross.
Do you think handing Catherine the giant stake is really like a Buffy the Vampire Slayer reference?
Oh, maybe. It could be.
She's wearing like a black leather jacket in that scene.
Yeah, so maybe.
And the vibes, although she does stroke her steak quite phallically, which I do not think was an accident. Whether because they did 30 takes and it happened one time.
Yeah, it just happened one time.
That's and the like, one they chose to use in the editing room. Or, you know, she did it on purpose, whether by direction or not. But I was like, that was like just a little over the top.
Yeah. Yeah.
Also, it's the world's biggest wooden stick.
It is.
You could kill a really big vampire.
Yeah, you could. Hey, I mean,
it's like elephant heart vampire.
Yeah, I mean, who knows? Maybe
Nick is this, or Warwick is this tiny little cross.
The little cross, yeah. He's fine. He'll be all right. We also learn in the scene that the victim had a blood alcohol level of 0.14%, but more importantly, she had consumed absinthe, which was illegal then. I don't know if it's legal everywhere. It's not legal in the US. Everywhere now.
I forget exactly what the law is that made it illegal. Yeah. I mean, they quote the timeline that he quotes is right. it became legal a few years after this episode was created.
Yeah.
And I think originally there was like an importer that was approved and then other things. So I don't know how the repeal, I don't know if the law was repealed or an exception was carved out or like just required them to do like follow certain things. But yeah, absinthe historically, little history lesson, banned by a lot of countries. It was banned all over Europe for years. Yeah. A lot of that was basically anti-hippieism because of the Bohemian movement and its association there.
Oh, okay.
You know, like basically prudence, you know?
Yeah.
Same thing that led to prohibition in the US, right?
Yeah.
And so, but, you know, it was popular, I think, because of the showmanship and the... And then, you know, just as anything becomes a fad, mystique or something, there's a weird thing you can do with absinthe where, like, it's very strong alcohol, but you put it in a glass and you pour water over a sugar cube.
Yeah.
And so then you basically add a like water and simple syrup to it. So you bring the ABV down, you sweeten it up, the whole nine yards. But there's something that happens with the chemistry and it causes some of the, because it's such a high alcoholic drink, it dissolves from like all the herbs and roots and stuff that they make the drink with, a bunch of compounds. And when you add water and it changes the chemistry, it all comes out and it makes a big cloudy drink. So it has this sort of like magical, there's a showmanship to the drink.
Yes. I've only seen it prepared once.
Yeah.
When I was in New Orleans.
Yeah. It's kind of cool. I imagine it's one of those things where it's cool the first couple times.
And then that person got very, very drunk.
Yeah. Well, depending, a lot of people will like make it and they'll put like way less water in it than they're supposed to. And then they're basically drinking shots.
Yeah.
And they're consuming beer and they're just consuming way too much alcohol.
Yeah.
But the big reason I don't call it like the mystery, but like the association was like, it would cause you to hallucinate and it's often been associated back. And Greg's going to mention this drug, this compound that's in one of the herbs that's used in making the drug. And that is like one of those things that's been misproven, but this is also a drink because of the way it was made, oftentimes made in certain ways that were maybe really, you know, wouldn't pass the FDA or alcohol, tobacco, whatever rules these days. And they would have like copper salts in those, and those things will make you go crazy. Yeah. And so just really poor quality chemical, like basically contaminated chemicals, it would make it into these drinks and then they would cause people to hallucinate. And so then some people think that the people would order it because it was like getting a drunk and a drug at the same time.
Yeah.
So it's funny. I had to go to Wikipedia and remind myself. So I can't take credit for just remembering all this. I was like, I got to look this up because I was like, I feel like this is really close to when it became legal again. Yeah. And then I was like,
I was only in New Orleans a few years after this and it was legal again.
Yeah. And it was probably legal in Europe when they made this episode, probably where like the idea came up. They're like, this is, you know, people have been reading about it or hearing about it. And I remember thinking like, forget what the real, like, I wanted to look up that drug because I remember, like, everybody always blames wormwood, but I remember that the thing is there's not enough in it to matter, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like there's arsenic in your apple, but it's not enough to kill you.
Yeah.
It's just in there, tiny amounts.
So this absinthe brings us to a sharp cut to a goth club / blood bar, and as we mentioned earlier, both of us used to frequent like goth industrial nights, so I did get a little tee-hee moment out of
it's really not that far-fetched
other it than really is
that,
not
other than like, the fact that everyone there is a model basically
that's I mean there are some gorgeous people there, don't get me wrong, but not every single person there, it's just normal
bar, it should be a normal sampling
normal sampling of people. And Warwick and Catherine then are joining Lazarus at the bar. And he admits to having a drink with the victim last night, I think I caught this on the second watch through. He then later on the night went over to her court and daggered the relationship, aka broke up with her.
Yes.
But at first I was like, maybe I didn't hear what he quite said. And I was like, what? It was on the second watch through that. I was like, can't you just say you broke up? I know it's like a whole bunch of vampire.
All the people in this episode to speak weirdly, I mean, it does track.
It does track. And we also learn that, I guess, previous to daggering, she was his donor. And the pendant that he has around his neck that has blood in it was hers. And he said, he's like, I tried to give it back to her. And she said no to keep it. But they were like, well, we're going to take it now. So they take the pendant. We go to Nick Grissom and Sarah watching security footage. And
yeah, by the way, totally like hands over his DNA, like freely.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Catherine's like, oh, we're also going to need a DNA sample. And he's like, yeah, no problem. Like,
well, whatever. They also want to like show you he has fangs as well.
Yes. Yes. He had nice fancy fangs. So as Nick, Sarah, and Grissom are looking over the security footage, it appears that the suspect in question that they're watching knew where their cameras were. Like, they knew, like, how to hide their face. Nick points out that it looks like the person crapped their pants. And Grissom's like, that's probably the money, because money, like, weighs a lot. And they would have had to, like, strap money to them.
How much does it weigh?
We'll find out. And the last bit that they get on the camera is them getting into the car with the security guard that was taped up.
I love that they spent all this time in avoiding the camera and then forgot of the one in the parking lot.
Yep. And we're then with Warwick and Catherine again. They're back with Greg Sanders. The saliva that was taken from the victim is not Lazarus, so not a match there. And in examining the blood that was in the pendant, it was prepped for HIV testing. There was like a compound in it that like separates the blood out to like prepare
the polyester or something. It's a very common thing. And I was like, I've never heard it used in that context. And it was just like, oh.
Okay. Polymer?
No, I think it's polyester.
Is it polyester? Okay. We then have, as Nick alluded to earlier in the episode, Nick using a software to measure features of the suspect and build a face. So good conference work there, Nick. Nick and Sarah then with a lifeguard, and he IDs the reconstructed face as Nathan, as someone who worked at the casino. We then have Grissom and Sarah. They're talking about the sword. Nick tape lifts the sword and breaks it, like rips a piece off of it. And as they dig a little bit further, this sword ain't a real sword.
I love that he was like, oh, sword. He was like, be careful.
Yeah. And then he's like, Grissom, how good is our insurance? Like,
wasn't there another recent episode where Nick broke a piece of evidence or something? And it was like a very similar line and like led to them finding something else out.
I don't know. It's not ringing a bell for me at the moment, but if it comes to me, I'll let you know.
I can't place it, so I can't. Maybe, I don't know, yeah. Maybe I'm misremembering something. Yeah. But I got that feeling, and I was like, they're reusing the same trope. I was like, but it was in a very different way. Like, I think the last time it was, you know, real, where, you know, it happened to lead to something else. Or is this one like, it broke, not because it wasn't being careful, it broke because it was Fabergé egg or paper mache, basically. That's what I'd say.
Yeah. So this brings Nick, Sarah, and Grissom back with the other items in the vault, and they realize the entire collection is fake, not just the sword, whole thing is fake. So Grissom goes and tells Mr. Caulfield, who is not happy about this news. We then have Grissom, Mr. Caulfield, and his security entering Mr. Yaramoto's suite. He's not there. He has left town. And this is where Grissom points out that three employees from the casino, as well as Mr. Yaramoto, have all disappeared. Isn't that weird? this scheme is about, and then suddenly, three employees and Mr. Yaramoto, nowhere to be seen.
I do like that they had this like weird like chase, like rush scene down the hallway.
Yeah, like yeah.
It's very like action movie.
It is very action movie. Yeah,
heisty movie. Yeah,
agreed. Agreed. Definitely the entire vibe there. We then go to a man drawing blood. Catherine and Warwick are at the door, and we learn from this tech that he's the only tech that works at this clinic, and he remembers the victim. And Warwick produces a warrant as he's already like digging around in this tech's personal fridge, and there's a canister of blood there in his personal fridge. So they're like, we're gonna take this.
Does he admit in the scene that it's hers?
No.
Okay, it's a later scene.
It's a later scene. Yeah.
Obviously, they can test it and find out. Yeah. I do love there's a woman, right, that he's drawing blood from when he comes in.
Yeah.
She's credited as like HIV woman.
Oh, is she?
That's like her IMDb.
Oh, no. Honey.
It took me a second to realize who it was. When I saw it, I was like, HIV woman.
Oh, poor woman.
Very great, great, great credit on her. HIV test woman.
Yeah, okay. I mean, that's, yeah, yeah.
And so also, if the only thing they do there is test people for HIV, then like a little creepy to be just like walking in as she walks out.
Yes. Oh, agreed.
Because, like, I would assume
there's like some HIPAA violation, right? More
privacy set up for you. I also assume that you wouldn't have a lab that only ever tests HIV.
No, I don't think so.
All sorts of things. Yeah.
So we then we're with Sarah, Nick, and Grissom at HQ. They have like all of the collection, all the fake items from the collection are out on a table. They're discussing them. And they, in IDing some of the components of these items, they are able to tie all of those components to orders related to Chen's scenic prop house. So Nick, Sarah Grissom, and Jim Brass arrive at said prop house. And as the CSIs are kind of looking around, I'm proud of you, Jim Brass. Jim Brass gloves up, puts a glove on to go expose a wallet and like open up a wallet. And look at that. Mr. Chen is our one and only Mr. Yamamoto.
He's not even Japanese.
He's not even Japanese.
I did not get the line at the start of this scene where Brass is like, Grissom, this is what I thought what I imagine your house might look like.
Yes. Yeah.
Because like, Grissom does not come off to me as a kind of person with clutter or like a lot of material goods. If anything, maybe if he just had a lot of bugs on display.
I think he just meant like a bunch of stuff.
We've been to Grissom's apartment. I don't know what other character was there.
Have we been to Grissom's apartment already?
Yeah. I guarantee it.
I know future scenes where we're at Grissom's apartment. Yeah. I can't remember what scenes we...
I was trying to remember what episode it was from. But also, okay. Again, my memory is just not there this week.
Yeah. No, I'm not doing any better, and I have no excuse, so...
But I was trying to figure out if it was a Brass. I was like, because that's what I wanted to know. I was like, wait, has Brass been to Grissom's apartment?
I don't think so. No, I don't think it was Jim Brass.
They've known each other long enough that it's possible, right?
Yeah.
It's possible. Maybe it hasn't happened on camera, but.
Yeah. And we also realized that all the missing employees are on a poster together, a Gilbert and Sullivan poster. And look at that. That ties back to the little musical code.
Mikado or whatever.
Mikado?
Yeah.
I think it's Mikado. And this is where Grissom poses the question to Nick about how much does $10 million weigh?
Yeah. Curious. Grissom also sings a little song, right?
Yeah.
Which the idea is... So I feel like we're far enough now. I want to talk about this.
Yeah. We're almost near the end of the episode, so...
Oh, this recorder. All right. Okay, there's one more piece of... We've already sort of alluded to it, but there's one more missing piece in this, which is that the casino manager is in on this job.
Yes.
The casino manager has set his code to be this song from this Gilbert and Sullivan play, Mikado, that all these people happen to have been acting in.
Yes.
Which also, they're actors, which is great, right?
Yeah.
The need to record his PIN code is farcical because he could have just given out the PIN code. It's just for the ruse.
Yes.
It's just part of the convincing.
Yes.
And it's really good convincing, but it also becomes his undoing.
It does become his undoing.
He didn't think it through. So it was both like a red herring and a non-red herring
at the same time.
True story. And I absolutely love that for some reason.
You were like, yes.
I was like, this is so clever, but also kind of exposed you.
Yeah.
But also like, it's so good. It's like they were putting themselves in the mind of a heist movie and like layering it. Like there's an intention to layer these crimes, right?
Yeah.
Fake the dead body to fake stealing the sword to then really steal the money, right?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
They thought this all through and then what do we have to do here? Just the way that like people are writing stories or directing or, you know, it's very theater-esque to think about like, I'm going to put myself in the mind of the person who's going to do that. Like, what would I need to do? And it's like, it's just there's so many other ways you could have explained that away.
Yeah.
You heard, oh, your keypad is musical. Oh, when he was inside, he would have heard you locking up.
Yeah,
so that they would have known how, he would have just had to figure it out. You know, it's a musical theater person. He could have perfect, like they could have done it. But no, they put this little recorder there. And also when Grissom starts to sing the song, they play the little,
the notes.
Subtly play the music in the background so that as the audience can do it. And I was like, it just worked so well that I was like, this is just a really great piece of evidence because it is both important and unimportant. It's both a good guy thing and a bad guy thing, kind of like.
Yeah.
It was great. I was like, I don't know. There's just something about it. I loved it because it required, like, it tells the story of the level of effort and energy and thought that goes into it. It's one of those things where, like, they don't have to, like, tell you the story. They just sort of show you.
Yes.
Like, they never have a scene where they, like, explain how they plan this whole thing out.
No. We never get that.
You know, but they give you all the information you need so that you fill that in your brain, right? It's like the difference between, like, you watch a movie or like a fantasy show or something, and if they just talk at you and tell you everything, it's not as good as when they like lay it out for you, right? And that's what I think makes a really good storytelling, is they're bringing you along on the story and making it accessible to you. But in this way, they're also like, it's a key component of the story.
Yeah.
It's so good. I don't know. It literally like checked every box for me. I was like, this is such, I didn't think of it the first one. It was the second watch through. I was just like fascinated with this little recorder thing. I was like, they didn't need to do that. Why did they do that? I was like, oh, but it works so well. And oh yeah, it comes back up. I was like, oh, that was just a really cool piece of evidence in this whole episode.
Agreed.
All right. That's the end of my love story to this.
All right. Sweet. Okay.
Little musical recorder.
I'm for it. So we are with Catherine and Warwick. They're back with the lab tech, but now in interrogation. And this is where we learn that the blood from the fridge is the victim's, Angela's. But when he's trying to say, oh, this was just like additional blood that when she came in for her HIV testing that I extracted, because she said that was cool. But she came in for HIV testing like 20 days ago, 25 days ago, something along those lines. And the blood in the fridge was less than a week old. So like that timeline's not matching up. And we also learn that he thinks he's the real deal when it comes to vampires. Like, he's the real thing. He's not like Lazarus putting on a show. He's the real deal. And then I had to word that he has a very rosy recollection of the crime.
Yes.
Like, because I do like this contrast. We hear his take on what happened.
Yes.
Which is like, oh, she invited me in. Oh, we kissed. Oh, we all these things. But as he's saying this, we're seeing the actual reenactment of the crime, wherein she doesn't recognize him, he barges into the house, he attacks her, he kills her. But
it's also like he's deluded himself, right?
Yes. Oh, 100%. Yeah. Like, I think we're supposed to interpret this as he is crazy to a degree that he actually believes this, and he's not just saying this to purposely set up for an insanity.
Yes.
Plea. Like he
he's actually this. He's actually deluding himself, right?
So that is the end of storyline B, and then we wrap up storyline A with the scene where Nick recognized our spot the guest star. Grissom places the money bands on Mr. Caulfield's desk.
I thought there was money in the bag. Like the whole first time I watched the scene.
Oh, did you? Yeah,
no. He's like, this is what's left of your thing.
Yeah, yeah.
The second time I saw that, it was just the bands. I think because I knew where the rest of the scene was going.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, what did I think? I was assuming there were just a few bills left.
No. It was the money bands. And this is where we learn that $10 million weighs 220 pounds. So how would little old Nathan, who only weighs 140 pounds, be able to carry out on his strap to his person 220 pounds?
You saw how he was walking, right?
I did see how he was walking. But even more importantly,
what does the guy say? He's like, strap a young lad or something.
Yeah. He says it in a really good tone. Like, that was a very good, how he delivered that, like, oh, what is strapping?
Well, at this point it pivots, right? He knows Grissom knows.
But he also knows that Grissom doesn't have enough to.
Yes.
Because he's like, oh, he's like, if you had enough on me, we'd be in interrogation having this conversation. We wouldn't be sitting in my office having this conversation. But another piece that Grissom shares is, fun fact, the only way to get money out of the bands is to tear the bands. You can't slide. Like, they are wrapped around the money so tightly. So the only reason that the bands were left in the vault was so that Mr. Caulfield could go to the insurance company and say, hey, here's proof that there was $10 million of money in this vault. But there wasn't $10 million of money in that vault because you just had empty money bands. Because if there was money in those bands, they would have had to rip the bands.
I think it's a little funny to think about, like, somebody had to, like, obviously you have to, like, get the money bands on the money.
Yes.
And I was trying to figure out, I don't actually know how this works. So I was trying to figure out, like, did they, like, have to, like, tape, like, where did they get all the empty money bands from?
Yeah.
You know, I just assume they came like that and they, like, squeezed the money in. But if you could squeeze the money in, you get the money out. So then it didn't make a lot of sense. But I believe them.
Yeah. And as Nick mentioned, Mr. Caulfield realizes that, like, Grissom knows, but he doesn't have really enough to do anything. But Grissom's like, okay, you know, eventually one of these people is going to come back and we'll have a witness. And Mr. Caulfield's like, well, until then. And well, Grissom's like, but I am going to talk to the insurance company. So, like, you're probably not going to get your money. Okay, bye-bye now. And then whistles his way out of Mr. Caulfield's office.
This is also not the first time they've been like, oh, I'm going to tell the insurance company on you. This is the one way we're going to get you. Like, you're going to get away with it, but you're not going to get paid.
And that is the end of the episode. So, Nick, what did you think about today's episode?
I really liked today's episode. Although I feel like I gave it a little bit of a hard time when we were watching it. In general, I like it. Gave it 4 stars.
Okay.
I was seriously considering giving it 4.5 stars after the first watch through. And I was like, oh, I got to watch it again. And there were things, I am giving a rewatch. I did enjoy the rewatch, but I think that it was interesting how the thing is, like, I feel like the episode is better. Part of the value of the episode is it's like one of those things where, like, the Sixth Sense movie will never be as good as the first time you watch it.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Or something like that. And it's like, so I was like, I give it 4. So, but I was very, very close to giving it 4.5 stars. I thought I was going to, I was like, if this is a good rewatch, I'm giving this episode 4.5 stars, and I rewatch it, and I was like, it was a fine rewatch. Like,
yeah.
I'll give it a rewatch. There were a couple things I picked up on the second watch through, and that I liked, but I was just like, but then, as I mentioned, then I also started picking up on negative things, and I was
I
kind of alluded to it earlier. I was like, oh yeah. I was like, I wish I didn't find these things because. Yeah. I wanted to give it a higher rating. Like, I was like, nope, I'm going to stick to my guns and be fair. So yeah, I think this is the closest I've been. I don't know that I've given anything 4.5 stars, or maybe I have, but, like, I don't give things, get into high numbers often.
It has been very, very sparingly.
Yeah. I'm just trying to remember. I was trying to figure out the episode I thought Grissom's apartment was in. Cause I think it's in the episode with the crazy doctor lady who I think eats people. I can't remember, but it was like one of my favorite episodes from the first season.
That was your favorite episode from the first season. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was like, for some reason I think it's in that episode. And then I was like, I bet you I'd give that episode 4.5 stars.
You're like, I probably give that one a 4.5.
I was like, remembering it. I was like, it's in my, I have a second notebook. I'm in the second notebook now. So I don't have the other ones put away. So I don't have my notes at hand to look back at it. But I was like, I don't know if I'll update the listeners, but I'll update you when we record next time. I'm going to go figure out what episode I think Grissom apartment's in. Right. It might turn out to not be his apartment.
Maybe.
I mean, we'll but I have out. A visual of it in my head. So
you,
if I
you
see
might
it,
entirely I'm be right. I, the few scenes that I can vividly recall that take place in Grissom's apartment have not happened yet, but that's not to say that we haven't seen his apartment yet. It's just, like, the scenes that I can vividly remember are later on in the series. So for me, I give this episode a 3.5 stars out of 5, like, better than average episode. And I will say again, pleasantly surprised. This was another one where when I saw it was this episode, I was like, oh, I don't like this episode. And then when I watched it, I was like, this is a good episode. I like this episode. Why did I think I didn't like this episode?
So that
was a nice surprise.
You can't be guessing the whole time. It was good. It was well done. It felt like a heist movie. Like you felt like you were doing the heist movie in reverse kind of thing.
Yes. It had fun. This is like one of those like fun CSI episodes where it's like there. It's kind of like it's similar to kind of like when they had the little bit of the film noir vibe when they did like the theater one. They have like the heisty movie vibe in this one as they're trying to deal with this heist and entire teams involved. There's no like real character development, but I feel like after last week's episode of like very heavy character development and like a big like a landmark movement in like a character's story, that it's okay that we didn't really get character back. You know what I mean? Like all the characters were involved, everyone played a part, two storylines, fun times were had. So and a decent rewatch. I think I will say that like this is another one where it's like, is the rewatch right after it great? Probably not. But this
maybe
was
after you forget part of it.
Yes, yeah. But this was fun to rewatch like 2 years later. You know what I mean? Like this was a fun one to come back to and be like, oh, I actually like this episode. So overall, pretty fun episode, 3.5 out of 5 stars. And we'll see how we feel next week when we return to review season 4, episode 14, Paper or Plastic. Otherwise, we will talk to you then.
No spoilers.
No spoilers.